Your recording has already been started. You may now proceed.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Translation and Transliteration of Contact Information PDP Working Group on the 19th of March 2015. On the call today, we have Amel Sadeh, Chris Dillon, Howard Lee, Jim Galvin, Peter Green, Beta Reinfort, Bettina Nkwama, and Sarah Bocchi. We have received an apology from Rudy Vansnick, and from staff we have Lars Hoffman and myself, Natalie Perrodin. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you so much, and over to you, Chris.
Thank you very much indeed. And as usual, I need to ask number three on the agenda, if anybody has a change statement of interest since our last call, then please let us know. Seeing nothing in the chat room and hearing nothing, that means we can move further down the agenda. And today we will be looking at the review tool, especially from row 87 onwards. The version of the document in front of us is slightly out of date. But I think between rows 69 and 83, we need to rely on notes for this week, in fact. But before we do the last four comments that require attention, I just ask whether anybody has anything to say about things we have already discussed. All right. In that case, I am about to start with comment 87. After finishing the four comments, I am intending to start work having a look at the draft final report from the expert working group on IRD. That means that we've then cleared away all major documents, as far as I know, before we start working on the final, on our final report. The other thing is that I am intending to do the draft final report from the EWG in a slightly unusual order, because I actually want to start on page 11, because there is technical linguist stuff on page 11, and then we can go back to the beginning and work through it pretty systematically, but I think it would be good to start there. Anyway, without further ado, let us scroll down to comment 87 and pick up the story there. Whoops, I think I've gone. That looks really good. Okay. So, so we've got the increasing excuse me, I have caught a bit of a cold and I'm quite croaky today. So the increasing internationalization of the Internet, besides creating new business opportunities for domain name holders, induces responsibilities for registrants, registries, and registrars to maintain reliable and internationally readable Whois information. What I would like to pick up in this comment is just that there may be, we can sort of say reliable and internationally readable. Well, if internationally readable is another way of saying, putting it in a language that everybody understood, if only there were such a thing, then there is actually a tension between that and reliable, because as we have said on numerous previous occasions in this working group, reliable is surely the original data. So I would like to say that there is just a little tension between those two things. don't know whether anybody would like to add anything to that comment. Ah, yes. In fact, in the chat room, Amar is typing, internationally readable seems hard to define. Yes. Yes, I mean, I'm guessing that it means perhaps ASCII, which is at least a script which many people currently understand. That becomes quite possibly less the case as India, Africa, China become more dominant in our industry. But yes, I think that's I think that's how I would read it. Petter, would you like to pick up something there?
Yeah, Petter here. Thinking of what we have discussed previously, the possibility to have two versions readable. When you make a WHOIS search, so if we take this as two parts of it, the reliable, as said, basically, if we talk about it in a more legal way, would of course be the original. But to combine that with an international readable WHOIS information, and I think we have, I don't remember what our conclusions were on that possibility, but we have at least discussed it before, as I have in mind. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, there is perhaps on top of this also a possibility, there is also the question, to what extent do we need to be able to read it? It may be that we can do many functions without actually reading it. We can copy it and then search for it and do things like that. Amma, would you like to pick this up?
Thanks, Chris. This is Amar. Yeah, just coming back to Petter's last comment, I do agree. We did discuss scenarios in which we might have recommended more than one field being present in the WHOIS, one with the original reliable information and one with perhaps a transformed version. And this is irrespective of whether we decide it is desirable to make this transformation mandatory or not. I don't mind recommending that a second field be made available for registrants or registrars that wish to transform data on a non-mandatory basis. However, I don't think it's necessarily within the scope of this PDP to make that recommendation. So maybe what we could do is maybe recommend that in another PDP that this issue be looked at more closely. Perhaps something like the post EWG PDP. But as long as we do stick to a non-mandatory basis for having to transform data. Thanks.
Thank you very much for that. I'll just have a look in the chat room now, one or two comments. Jim is saying readable might just mean accessible. Right, yes. Okay. With which Amar is agreeing. And I wonder whether that may mean that we can get onto the last page of this now and head down to 92. So scroll down there, perhaps. And I'm aware there are things going on in the chat room, but I shall come to those in a moment. So mandatory transformation would see a shift in costs away from those requiring transformation to those who do not. So registrars, registrants, with potential negative impact on underserved regions. Yes, and I mean this would certainly seem to be likely. And on the other hand, this is an argument with which we are fairly familiar, I think. I don't think it's a very new argument. All right, now looking at the chat room, and this is actually going back to the last comment. Amar is saying adding internationally to readable does not necessarily imply universally readable, but I suspect that FICPI intend on something to that end, okay. And being cognizant that a universally readable is also impossible to achieve. Yes, well, we've certainly had discussions about not wanting to recommend anything that's impossible. All right. Okay, so whether we want to pick up anything else with 87 or 92, I think there are things happening in the chat room, but let us make a bit of progress and go to 94, and we can always come back if necessary. So registrars are potentially unable to validate information data. I do wonder whether we need to define exactly what sort of validation we're meaning here, syntactic, operational, or identity. It seems a little vague, my initial impression of that. Now, there are things referring back to previous comments going on. Oh, yes, I realize this way of working is slightly confusing. So let's, first of all, we're talking about internationally, the difference between internationally and universally. That's being pointed out by Petter. And we're now on 94, which is registrars are potentially unable to validate information data, and I'm raising the point that validate is a horrendously vague term, and I think it might help to point out whether it's syntactic, operational, identity, or some combination there. Amr, would you like to say something about that? Sorry, I didn't see your hand.
Thanks, Chris. I would need to refer back to the NCSG comment to understand this sentence within the full context. But in terms of validation, this is, as far as NCSG is concerned, I think we use that pretty uniformly to mean sort of just making sure that, for example, as in a physical address, that this city does indeed exist, and this street does indeed exist in this city, and this street number indeed does exist on this street in this city. So that's probably what is meant by validation here. It's not necessarily verifying that this information, this physical address belongs to this registrant, but just validating that this information is factually in existence. And validating contact information is extremely problematic because it's very impractical for registrars to attempt to validate all contact information. And with increasing internationalization of domain name registrations, and if we foresee that happening, especially with new IDNs, validating contact information in different countries will just increase the unlikelihood of that being practical or even possible. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I think those are very, very good points. All right. Unless there's anything else about 94, that means we're on the last row, 95. And that is searching in the original script will be far more reliable than searching in transformed data, since consistency will almost be impossible to achieve. Okay, so let's just look at this in two parts. So searching in the original script will be far more reliable than searching in transformed data. So, you know, the idea here is that the original script is in many ways primary. You've more of a chance of matching things within the original version, often. And then pointing out the fact that if there is a transformation, particularly if it is done by, or particularly if transformations are done by many parties, consistency will be almost impossible to achieve. So these are both things which we have spoken about before, and I believe that's more or less where we are with them. Amr, would you like to pick up something in there?
Yes, Chris. I believe in this statement, this is Amr for the transcript. In this statement here, I think it's especially relevant when a search for a registrant is being done using cross-referencing the registrant name or physical address across a different with different registrations, especially if they're coming from different registrars. There may be variations in how the contact information is transformed, so it'll actually make cross-referencing far more difficult. So if searching and cross-referencing is done in the original language and script, it probably would yield more accurate results, or at least more complete results. Thanks.
Thank you very much for that, because you know, one can certainly think of situations where in the original script cross-referencing would be straightforward. However, if it's transliterated using more than one transliteration, for example, then you can end up with entries which are so different that cross-referencing is highly likely to fail. All right. Anything else about number 95? Well, that means that we're at the end of the document. Now, Amma, is that an old hand or?
Chris, this is Amma. No, this is it's a new hand. I wanted to just take a minute to go back to number 92, which we didn't talk about, if that's all right.
Yes, absolutely. Shift of cost.
Yeah, I think this is a... Yes, I think this is something that I've raised before, and I think it was also, if I recall correctly, in the original NCSG submission during the early stages of this PDP. We recognize that there is obviously a transaction cost in transforming contact information when that is necessary. The question here is, who does this transaction cost fall on? Who bears the burden of this cost? So in the NCSG's view, the who is, for other reasons, for historic reasons beyond the scope of this PDP, obviously needs to be accurate and up-to-date and available. However, a transaction cost which will exist in the future, and its existence may increase in the need to transform contact data this transaction cost is I think more to the benefits and the limited benefits of those who are performing the WHOIS lookups, and a decision by this PDP to make transformation mandatory on registrants or contracted parties would shift this cost away from those who are benefiting from the service to others who are not. And I think this is a crucial issue in the lack of a justification of recommending mandatory transformation. Thanks.
Thank you for expanding that. So any other comments on 92? Or any other row in the spreadsheet? All right. We will now work to update the spreadsheet and circulate it probably within the next few working days. I'm doing some amount of traveling in the near future, but even so. In that case, I think it may be time to move over to the draft final report from the EWG on IRD. I'm hoping that we've got that handy to be loaded in the chat room window.
Chris, I'm sorry.
Difficulty there. Is it going to help if I paste a URL in so that we can have a look at the document, perhaps? Now, let's have a look. Okay, there is a URL there in the chat room. And what I'm intending to do, I don't like starting in the middle, but I think on this occasion I would like to start on page 11 of that document. Aha, it's coming in the middle, super. Just in case page 11 takes a lot of time. So, as you can see, we have it is the example of WHOIS output localized for English-speaking audience. So that is a lovely size. Okay. So, what I wanted to raise was that the data that we see here is very, very clean. I mean, it's this is a really, really nice English record for the Japanese address that we can see on. I'll just show you that very briefly. The original is on page 10 up here. There it is, and then this address on page 11 is then the transformed address, and the data is lovely. I mean, this is just if you were writing a letter to that company, then this is really the kind of address that you would want to use. And the reason I, as a linguist, wanted to raise this right at the start of looking at this document was just to make clear that the likelihood is that the record has been done manually, I would say, because actually there are elements of both translation and transliteration in here, for a start. So, for example, if we look at the postal address, we've got the Chioda First Building, and... yes, this is very useful. Jim is saying in the chat room it was done manually. I'm very, very happy to hear that, because one would not want to give the impression that there was some machine out there somewhere that could produce a record as beautiful as this one automatically. I just don't think there is. And if I just take one or two... Yes, Jim is typing a lot in the chat room, so rather than me guessing, it's better to... yes, okay. So they've got some automation, but we cleaned it up for the document. Yes. All right. So, for example, this word, I would guess, and this is me guessing, but I think the word first, well, actually building as well, but first, probably was tied, it was cleaned up, because usually, or the most frequent translation of first in Japanese buildings is actually the word daiichi. So, you know, first insurance, daiichi seime, something like that. Now, here, in fact, it's interesting because it's coming from an English word. It's fastobiru has been transformed as first building, you see, the interesting thing here, it's a lovely example, because the word fasto in Japanese could be first, as it is here, but it can also be fast. So, for example, in Japan, there is a chain of fast food restaurants called First Kitchen. And there's always been a bit of a suspicion that there was a problem with the transformation. And actually, it was Fast Kitchen. But if you look at the English form, it's First Kitchen. Because in Japanese, fasto could be first or it could be fast. We don't know. It's just... that's an unusual thing to see in the chat room. Anna has got the smiley face. So this is a lovely example of where you can have different possible ways of transforming. This is really the point that I'm making with this. But I was very happy to see this example, because I think it makes the point rather nicely. Now, that then enables us to address one or two points which are made. So under the table, we've got... it is essential to understand that the original data could have been in either form, Japanese or English. Well, Amar is saying the fast food example is amusing. It's really most fortunate that this word first was in this record, because it just allows us to indicate some most interesting things in a way that's quite easy to remember as well. I was very pleased to see it. So essential to understand that the original data could have been in either form, Japanese or English. Well, yes, but you see, we've got these sort of multiple things which are not quite matching. And then we've got, since each form can be derived from the other through translation and transliteration, not really, because you see, if you go from first, you probably end up with daiichi, in fact, and then you might get fast, although that is not a very likely possibility. And then if in Japanese you have fast, you may get first, but you may also get fast. And you see, the whole thing becomes a real mess. So I think we can use the this particular example, just to draw attention to various possible weaknesses actually in the arguing here. I think that's what it comes to. We then go on to the effect of this observation is that no single internationalized form must exist. I'm just reading that. It's rather difficult to, you know, this concept of internationalized form. I mean, you can sort of think of the Japanese original form as being primary, and then conceivably the Romanized transformed form is then the internationalized form. But it's not necessarily the case that it's particularly easy to get between the two forms. Okay. Now I'll just come back into the chat room and we'll pick up one or two things in here. So Jim says he can't speak to the specifics of the transformation. And he says he's amused in a good way that that Chris is picking apart the example. It is a most fortunate example, because it is a wonderful example of just effectively how languages are rather like little bushes. So often people think that in languages, oh, you know, each leaf on the one bush will correspond to a leaf on the other bush. That's just not how it works. So you have all of these different leaves, and they don't necessarily correspond. And so this whole process of transformation is really very, very complicated. And particularly when we're translating, we can end up in some very funny places. If we decided to transliterate, then that's a different matter. We could get this address into transliteration pretty consistently, actually, but it would not look anything like as clean as it does on page 11. All right, now back into the chat room. Justine is saying, right, so there is still automation. There is still an automation solution which knows when to translate and when to translate. No, there isn't such a thing. So here we have a person that did it, and we are probably a long way before we will have an automated solution there. And then Jim is saying the only thing I can think of to say is that we're trying to make a point. Perhaps there are better examples, but as I'm sure you can appreciate it, it's all very difficult. Yes, absolutely. And then Justine is saying, I mean, so there is still no automation which knows when to... Yes, okay, that's it. So when to translate or when to transliterate. So, yes, the truth is basically that there is no automatic solution, and one is a very long way away. Then Jim is saying, hopefully you're not going to suggest we explain all this in our final document where this is what you're saying. No, the thought crossed my mind that we may want to make a public comment on this. Anyway, we can think about that in slow time. Then Jim is saying, also note, we're trying to show an idyllic final solution. Right. Oh, yes, that's interesting. I have to admit, I have been more interested in showing solutions which are not idyllic, but or not ideal, but maybe closer to what we can achieve in the near future. And the transliteration approach somewhat closer. In fact, would it be helpful for me to give you an idea of what a transliterated approach would look like, and then you can compare them? That will only take seconds. I'll do it. Just a moment.
This is Jim, Chris, if I may, while you're doing that.
Okay, so there it is in the chat room. As you can see, that would be the order may be wrong, but there may be ways around that, in, just by indicating what the various fields are doing in the database. And that this is a solution which is not using diacritics. If you had diacritics, then that would look slightly different. Jim, would you like to say something?
Yes, thank you. So, Jim Galvin for the transcript. Just quickly, I want to kind of wrap up, maybe talk a little bit about the perspective from which we were coming from, and remind people we do say this earlier in the document, but because we are, or this group was an expert working group and not a PDP group, although we considered, carefully some practical issues, and as a result of that, we do have a section here where we talk about some technical issues about achieving a final solution, we really took the approach that we should look at what would one like to achieve and where do we want to be, to sort of put a goal out there, and then recognize that there will be follow-on work from here as an appropriate group of people, discuss in more practical terms what's achievable and what's not and what a transition plan might be. So, this example, it's interesting. I enjoy listening to talk about the I'll call them flaws for the moment here, in this example. But, it highlights this problem in general, which we're all quite familiar with. And there was certainly no intention. We did not intentionally want to demonstrate the things that you're talking about, Chris. And I'm not sure if I want to add to the document and try to explain all of that. If you were to do that, it might be better to find a way to include it in the technical issues discussion. So that actually might be useful, Chris. Maybe that's something you and I could talk about anyway, independent of whether this group decides to make a public comment about this. We should talk a little bit about the difference, all the things that you just said, find a way to summarize that and observe it as an issue. My point really is, idyllic example, this is where we want to get to, and all of these issues that you're talking about were intended to be exposed by this process. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jim. Let's follow this up in detail after today's call. My concern in bringing it up was that I felt that the example might give the impression that it was very easy to produce clean data, just the reality is that at the moment, admittedly it is very clean, but at the moment it has to be done by a human being. But thank you very much for the input. We'll talk about this offline afterwards, I think that this is really the only sort of very linguisticy bit of this document, in fact. And so we can now go back to the beginning and just work our way steadily through it. Now, I'm aware that Amma is typing something, but I think... Oh, yes. Okay. So there's an amusing go at transforming some Arabic. Yes, I can just imagine what happens when one takes a language which tends not to write the short vowels. Yes. Okay. Right. So let us go back to page 4. That's really where we get going in this document, apart from that cluster of interest on page 11. And so basically, one of the things is these three principles which are suggested, and I thought it was worth having a quick look at these, especially the first two. So we've got the user capability principle. So the capability of the data submitting user should be the constraining factor. And we need to think of that in, basically, can this person input data in this language effectively? That's made clearer further down. So we'll actually come back to this, but I feel this is rather relevant to us. Then we've got simplicity and reusability. So where possible, existing standards should be applied. Where simpler standards exist, they should be preferred. So I think we are certainly... it affects us in some ways because, you've got the UPU standards, and in the past we have said, well, actually, UPU are existing standards, but effectively it's a standard for each country, so it's not as straightforward as it seems, whereas transliteration maybe, just transliterate this according to your national standard, that may be simpler. Extensibility, so where possible the data model should be able to be easily extended to tailor to the evolution of data elements. So I think this is really on the edges. That might refer to a situation where, for example, sorts of contact information which aren't currently in the WHOIS need to be added to it, that sort of situation conceivably, but it's very much on the edge of what we do. Okay, and still on page 4, it's going to be easier if I use my hard copy, I think. Now, at the bottom, it's just spelt out a bit more. Registrants should only be required to input registration data in a language or script that they are skilled at. All data elements should be tagged with the languages and scripts in use. And this information should always be available with the data element. Now... one of the shocks which I had when I read this document, so it was a very interesting document to read, but it was actually this thing about tagged with the languages and scripts in use, because as we go a little bit further into it, we realize that it may be quite difficult to have a list of languages and scripts, and... we have presumed that we would just be able to put our hands on some list of languages and scripts, and there seems to be a real possibility that may not be straightforward. That was a bit of a shock, but that's spelled out a little bit more further down the document. So I'm just going to have a quick look at some things on page 5. The only thing I would like to draw your attention to is that whereas registrar name and postal address have got things about languages and scripts, personal names and organizational names don't have that restriction, and I'm actually not completely aware of what sort of ramifications that may have, but what I noticed is that there are restrictions on number 2 and number 3, registrar name and postal address, but not on number 1, personal names and organizational names. Perhaps we just need to bear that in mind. All right. If there are any points anybody would like to raise about any of this, of course, as usual, you are more than welcome so to do. But otherwise, let us continue as far as, I think it's page 9, our next stop. I mean, as usual, I am stopping at places I believe personally to be of greatest interest to us. It's only a personal opinion. If somebody finds some other parts of the document important, I mean, I have a bad feeling. I am missing things, so you are more than welcome to raise things I'm skipping over. But I thought that it would be worth just highlighting the difference between localization and internationalization. It's a key concept. So with the localization referring to the adaptation of a product, application or document to meet the language, cultural and other requirements of a specific target market, locale or purpose, whereas internationalization is the design and development of a product, application or document content that enables easy localization for target audiences. Just I wanted to stress that that distinction, because I think it has come up before in our meetings, but it's just one that it's good to have at the front of one's mind. Okay. Then we catch up with ourselves. Now we are at the bit that we started with, page 11, and for the first time in a while, we are making better progress than I expected we would. So that is wonderful news. Gradually scroll through the next few pages. We can stop if necessary. And in the chat room, Amma is saying to Jim, haven't gone through this yet, but very eager to. Okay. Yes, well, as you know, it is a most interesting read. All right. Now, bum. No, I think we go quite a long way this time. Yes, I think it's page 15 for our next stop. I'll just double check. Yes, as far as I know. Oh, yes, that's it. Okay. And the interesting bit here is the bit in the middle. So the current XML schema for DNRD does not support the representation of two forms. So to specify that the two forms represent the same record, there should be some indication of the relationship between them, preferred form, for example, and then specify the transformation information, whether it's translated or transliterated, and the date and time of the transformation, yeah. Okay, I think I just wanted to flag those things. I mean, also looking at that Japanese example, here we've got translated or transliterated. You almost need to put all some combination of the two, because manual transformation is involved, a nice clean version may well be that. Obviously, in the first bullet point, there is this reference to preferred form, and obviously we are wanting to say that preferred form would normally be the original data. Yes. Then we just go a little further down to page 16. Oh, yes, and this is the thing I was flagging up before. Where has it gone? Additionally, it's that paragraph. Standard list of languages and scripts. Now, the UPU has got a standard, but it's quite small, used by 40 countries. Okay, so you know, as I said earlier, this was a bit of a shock. I think this is something that we had presumed, and certainly looking at, I actually had a look in Wikipedia after this, so I started looking up languages, and I looked at the Korean language, and you know, I had, I think, yeah, that's right, I had two different words in the original script for the Korean language, one which is used in South Korea, one which is used in North Korea. What was even more interesting was that the South Koreans used one romanization, one transliteration for Korean, and the North Koreans used a slightly older transliteration scheme, but different anyway. and you know, there are other, you know, there are some pretty long lists of languages, so you know, maybe you know, this may, you know, there may be some ways of making progress here, you know, at least having a list of languages and scripts. All right. Now, if we go down to page 17, here we have rather an alarming thing, and it's a bit. I sort of read this and hoped, oh, I hope this isn't true because it's going to cause trouble. So this suggests that the Western convention of requiring an address to be in the form of a name, address line 1, address line 2, city, state or province, postal code and country may be inappropriate in an internationalized context. Oh, gosh. Huh. Yeah. This is really quite alarming because... you know, at least until now, we have been presuming that that kind of a format might get us a really long way. If I take a linguistic approach to this, it's like saying, we believe there's an irregular verb, and then the linguist said, yes, that sounds interesting now. Which verb do you mean? So what I would like to see is, I'd like to see the exceptions that are causing the author to write that. It is it is rather alarming. I mean, perhaps the modifications required are minor, but you know, that is quite an alarming thing. All right,
Chris, this is Jim.
Ah, yes, please bring up anything you would like.
I'm sorry, I'm not in the Adobe Connect room at this point anymore. Just quickly. Yes, I agree. That's a pretty dramatic statement. It really comes from recognizing the idea that postal rules really belong to the local regional authority, mm-hmm. the actual rules on what's allowed and what's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it seems odd that even if the UPU won't enforce a uniform format for addresses, it seems odd that ICANN would put it there. Now, perhaps we can add some additional clarifying text, I guess, as I'm listening to you talk, but the intent was not to suggest that anything has to change, because personally, I agree with you. What we have will certainly take us a long way. But I do think that in the overall context of internationalization, and again, thinking forward to sort of this idyllic kind of solution that we'd want to have, we need to recognize the fact that you know, perhaps there's a more general solution to what an address looks like. And if we're going to change things, we should be thinking about that as we, you know, consider what changes we might make. And this kind of point has not been documented anywhere else in the ICANN context that I could find. And mm-hmm. so I, you know, again, speaking personally, thought it was really kind of helpful, if not important, to at least mention it. In this document. So, but if you have some advice on, you know, how we might temper that statement so that, you know, you're concerned about what the consequences might be of it, I would welcome, you know, that input to the work party so that we can think about that. Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, in some ways, it's going back to an earlier point in the report where there is, the point made that a flexible data format has a huge advantage, because if we become aware of situations where this sort of traditional approach does not work, then if we have some flexibility, we may be able to, either to arrange existing fields and data in slightly different ways on occasions, depending on, which is the language of the interface viewing the data, or to possibly split existing fields into more than one field, so that it's clearer what the data are representing. I mean, the reason I was quite concerned about this is I just looked at it and thought, oh my goodness, if we can't rely on this, then it sort of represents possibly quite a delay. So fundamentally what I'm saying is if there's bad news, it's good to hear it early. That's really what I feel, and certainly there is an interest in looking for things which break this traditional model. That would really be my summary of it. All right. Now, I'm conscious that we are near the end of today's call, and unlike recent calls in which we have not made as much progress as I had hoped, we have made more progress than I expected with today's call. So that is a very good feeling, and I will pass my notes on the document on to Rudy, who is running next week's call. I am traveling, and in fact I shall be in Korea, and that means that it means this call is very late in the evening and so rather difficult to deal with. So I probably won't be able to attend it. It may also be that fairly soon, we've actually covered most of the points I was going to cover anyway. Very soon, well, not all of them, looking at my notes, but it may also be that at some point we'll have a rest and there will be work done on drafting the final report over the next few weeks. But obviously, I'll keep you all up to date with what is happening via the mailing list as usual. Any questions about any of that? I'm also aware that we need to update the work plan. At the moment, there is only quite an out-of-date work plan in the wiki, and it would be really good to have one with more likely dates in there. So, as I was saying, I wonder if there's anything you would like to bring up about what we'll be doing in the next few weeks. All right. Well, Amr, yes, would you like to raise something?
Yeah. Hi, Chris, this is Amr. Just a question. On reviewing the IRD EWG's report, and this is just the initial report, it's still in there's still an open public comment period on this report, and it may change. But on reviewing it here, I'm unclear on the intent. Will it somehow change the content of this PDP's report in any way? And from a process perspective, not very certain that this is appropriate at this point. Thanks.
Thank you, Amr. The reason I was keen to read this document in the group and read it critically as well, I think reading it critically is a positive thing to do, you understand things better if you give them this sort of critical attention. The reason for doing it is that soon we will be drafting our final report, and before we do that, I want to have read as many relevant documents as we possibly can together, because if from this point on other documents become we become aware of other documents which are relevant to us, it means adding content during our drafting process. So that is that makes the drafting far more difficult. So my idea has been simply to read everything we possibly could to understand our tasks as well as we possibly could, and so that's really been the idea. So yes, I mean, anything we read could affect our report, yes, because it may shine light on some area that we have missed out. So that's the sort of philosophy behind it. And Amar is kindly saying in the chat room that makes sense. All right. And I'll be absolutely honest with you. To some extent, I am hoping that nothing relevant comes up during the drafting period. If it does, that will add a little bit of time to what we're doing, and obviously we will address it. But I was keen to do as much as possible before we started drafting. Happen in, oh yes, Amber, would you like to raise something there?
Yeah, yes, I would just like to clarify my concern with this from the process perspective is that following the public comment period now open on this report, the IRD EWG itself may elect to make changes to its report. But from the context that you described, yes, that certainly does make sense. If there's information here that to us, whether it is amended or not, is certainly something we should be looking at. So thank you very much.
Thank you too. I should also say to the group, if anybody is aware of something important that we haven't read, then I am not. As far as I know, we have read everything. But if somebody is aware of something relevant, then that is something we need to pick up. And in a way, better to do it before we start drafting. We don't want to draft a document and then have to change it. That's really the idea. All right. Well, we're a little over the time, we are, I think, likely to, well, there will be a meeting probably next week with Rudy, then with me on the 2nd of April once I'm back, and obviously we will keep up to date on the mailing list as usual. So thank you very much for a call in which we have covered a huge distance today. All right. Goodbye, then, and many thanks.
Thanks, Chris. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Jen. We now stop the recordings.